Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Silencing of Ruby McCollum, Race, Class, and Gender in the South by Tammy D. Evans, narrated by Deanna Anthony. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Letter from Birmingham Jail, April 16, 1963. Foreword. Tammy Evans is a daughter of the South, and in the silencing of Ruby McCollum, Race, Class, and Gender in the South, she has researched and written a very Southern story. She chronicles the 1952 murder trial of Ruby McCollum, an African-American woman in the small Southern community of Live Oak, Florida. On the surface, the narrative is fairly ordinary rather than remarkable. A crazy 42-year-old African-American woman shoots and kills a prominent 44-year-old white doctor and state Senate nominee, Dr. C. Leroy Adams, for no good reason. Justice is served. McCollum is convicted and sentenced to prison. The no good reason, however, is Evans' story, and she tells it well. As only a good Southern daughter, who has gathered some very special analytical tools, who has developed a perspective enriched by a knowledge of the intersecting axes of social, political, and economic power, and who has a deep love and respect for her home, might carefully, critically, and lovingly do. In the introduction, Evans makes her ambitious intentions clear. I aim to exemplify how dominant power and capital structures in the early 1950s South worked to protect Southern myths regarding race, class, and gender, and more specifically, how these long-time myths contributed to the fate of one woman. Her purpose is not to elevate McCollum to heroism or to render in miscast 21st century nostalgia the violence of McCollum's disorderly action, or even to expose the historical misdoings of a quiet Southern town. I find that the most significant framework for understanding Evans's intentions is to note in this well-told tale that she defines the research writing task in a way that permits the localized focus on the McCollum story to reach out in compelling and instructive ways beyond itself. The silencing of Ruby McCollum serves as an instrument for enlightenment and socio-historical recovery, offering those of us who live now a more fully textured understanding of how critical resources can be brought to bear to gain knowledge of a self, a community, and a region that can ultimately be revelatory for a nation. In other words, this analysis not only meaningfully applies some pretty important terms of engagement, race, class, gender, and culture, to a 1950s story that took place in Live Oak, Florida, but also illustrates how this story speaks to a persistently troubled nation. The silencing of Ruby McCollum becomes a parable for interrogating complex personal, social, and political relationships. As this statement suggests, understanding Evans's ambitious rhetorical intentions to render more vibrantly and thereby to preserve more meaningfully the historical importance of the McCollum case pushes listeners to see larger implications. The core narrative of this analysis serves as a springboard by which Evans encourages listeners to see more clearly the rhetorical nature of silence and to see how understanding its performative nature helps us to gain a better sense of the truths, shadows, and consequences of what it has meant in Live Oak and, by extension, elsewhere, to turn the eyes, ears, mind, soul, and voice away from the socio-political hierarchies that surround us in sense-making, history-making, and knowledge-building. Evans writes, I am in dialogue with both McCollum's silent past and my own, and in the process I am becoming what Adrian Rich describes as consciously historical, that is, a person who tries for memory and connectedness against amnesia and nostalgia. Here I aim to challenge silences that for far too long have gone unbroken. By this approach, the silencing of Ruby McCollum becomes more than simply a curious narrative of things left unsaid in the legal case of one African-American woman and, in turn, a generous effort on Evanson's part to reinstantiate the fullness of McCollum's life and times. The account also becomes a display of values added to this storytelling, history-telling event through the mediation of theoretically well-grounded rhetorical analysis. It is, in fact, this scholarly dimension of the silencing of Ruby McCollum that, in my view, is particularly instructive to those of us in rhetorical studies and cultural studies. Evans uses John Searle's theory of first and second speech acts and the work of other scholars who are interrogating the notion of silence as a performative speech act to suggest that silence is a discursive and consequently cultural act. Positioning silence in the McCollum case as a performance that is vibrantly yoked to the spoken, the court records, and the written, earlier publications and the personal records of major parties in the case, performance draws critical attention to the constituent features of the processes and circumstances in McCollum's case that create the silence and make it work with such compelling force. Evans takes this approach not so much to just indict systems of oppression as to help listeners see the dynamic intersections and interactions of power in American lives, even in her own. Another important dimension of the silencing of Ruby McCollum, especially with regard to its placement, not just in rhetorical studies, but in cultural studies as well, is the particular voice and body through which this analysis is rendered. Evans is a native of the South, and indeed of Live Oak, Florida itself. She is a white, post-1960s woman who grew up among the economic elite of this town. In this case, she has researched and written about an African-American woman in her own hometown, a story that she could have ignored. In not ignoring it, she accepts the obligation of engagement across social boundaries and the obligation of not letting herself, her race, gender, and culture off the analytical hook. With this approach, Evans participates actively in the important work of raising a mirror to her own face, to the face of her home community, as well as to the face of our nation to enrich the critical or, perhaps more accurately, the non-critical perspectives that we have habitually held on such noble concepts as truth, justice, equality, and freedom. What becomes evident via this particular narrative is the power of beliefs, the power of social hierarchies, the power of silence, and the critical roles of public narrative in the making and sustaining of institutionalized memory. Listeners discover that there was another Ruby McCollum that had more to her than the one historically encoded in the public narratives of U.S. law and literature. In all likelihood, there was a truer McCollum, a person who was not permitted to emerge in 1952. Having a mechanism for debarking the context, circumstances, and conditions of McCollum's life and actions helps a more fully textured view to emerge, such that we have, by contrast to the 1952 story, good reason to conclude that McCollum was neither poor nor uneducated, as stereotypes might lead one to presume, and that there also was a pretty good chance that she was neither mentally ill nor even out of control. Quite likely, as Evans's analysis claims, she was instead an unprivileged and highly constrained African-American woman whose voice got muted and whose circumstances got overwritten by the institutionalized silences that so thoroughly and completely surrounded her and rendered both the particular realities in her life and their social and political implications unsayable by either McCollum or anyone else. The most important point that I'd like to underscore about the silencing of Ruby McCollum comes not from the Evans text itself, but from the fact that, by coincidence, I am writing in the midst of the horrific accounts of Hurricane Katrina and its devastating effects on the Gulf Coast region. This 2005 drama that continues to unfold is also a story of the South. It is yet another case in which the nation's deeply ingrained dynamics of race, class, and gender give rise to public interpretations of events that fall in line with well-established patterns. For example, the focus on the craziness of Mother Nature as opposed to analysis that meaningfully engages with issues of race, class, and gender. In 1952, the contours of the Ruby McCollum case were enveloped by silencing mechanisms of that era that contemporary theoretical frameworks make all too familiar to us today. However, in 2005, we are operating within our own, sometimes more subtle, versions of these very same mechanisms. The tragic stories of neglect and unresponsiveness that are emerging almost hourly from the Gulf Coast region demonstrate that so much in our contemporary lives and relationships remains just as deeply embedded within hierarchies of power as McCollum's case was over 50 years ago. In the Gulf Coast, we see the overwhelming evidence that the tragedies are about African Americans rather than whites. And when they are about whites, they are overwhelmingly about ordinary and lower class whites rather than affluent ones. We see that the impact of the devastation is keenly felt by women, children, and the elderly. The suffering, in fact, is inescapably heart-wrenching. We see the unmistakable consequence of not having the resources to evacuate an endangered area, and we see the equally unmistakable result of an affluent nation that has been interestingly slow, taking several days instead of what could have been hours, to respond to its own people, poor, black, infirm, and without status by various measures though they were. Indeed, there is much resonance between the case of Ruby McCollum in the case of the Gulf Coast tragedies. While divided by a half century, they are nevertheless part of the whole cloth of race, class, and gender experiences that has been the story of many, many generations now in the United States. There is no question about whether the embedding of hierarchies of power around these issues continues. Clearly, it does. The only real question is whether we have learned enough to do anything that is substantially different with regard to the fates of the people who are caught in such webs. Without a doubt, Evans and other scholars are giving more critical attention to our past and the residual forces of these histories. We understand more than we ever have about how past worlds were made and how the impacts and consequences of those composition processes have had and continue to have such compelling force. The excellence of this work, not only in rhetorical studies and cultural studies, but in other fields as well, has given us something that was not available in 1952, an opportunity to break amazingly resounding silences. Just as Evans helps listeners to understand that the silencing of Ruby McCollum is more than a sad and mysterious story, we now have the opportunity to see that recent Gulf Coast scenarios are more than unanticipated tragedies caused by unpredictable twists and turns of nature. With this moment of convergence between ongoing hierarchies and instructive theoretical frameworks, we have an occasion, and even an imperative, not to look away from material conditions and not to engulf the truths and consequences of those conditions in ironclad silences, but alas, to face these challenges head on, eye to eye, in order to take into account both the spoken and the powerfully unspoken, the said and the interestingly unsayable of our social, political, and cultural practices. With the silencing of Ruby McCollum and other works of this type, with Kevin Boyle's Arc of Justice being an excellent example, there is opportunity that we should not misuse. Jacqueline Jones Royster, Professor of English, Ohio State University, September 1, 2005. Introduction. Have you listened for the things I have left out? I am nowhere near the end yet, and already hear the hum of omissions, the chant of vacancies, din of silences. A. R. Ammons, Unsaid. Lines 1 to 6. On August 3, 1952, in the small community of Live Oak, Florida, a 37-year-old African-American housewife named Ruby McCollum shot and killed Dr. C. Leroy Adams, a 47-year-old white physician recently elected to the state Senate and rumored to be a strong contender for the governorship. Like most other small towns in the Deep South at the time of the murder, Live Oak was conservative in its politics and deeply committed in its faith. It was also strictly segregated, with black and white citizens alike knowing exactly what behavior was accepted and, more important, what behavior would not be tolerated. Of course, Adams's murder, a crime to which McCollum readily confessed, was heinous by any measure. According to firsthand accounts, the shooting was unprovoked, and since Adams was revered in Live Oak by both black and white citizens for his generosity and friendly nature, his murder caused an unprecedented backlash against McCollum. So intense was Live Oak's revulsion that immediately after the murder, McCollum was transported for her own safety under armed guard to the state prison nearly 50 miles away in Rayford. Her subsequent trial was deliberate and swift. When the jury convened for the last time, she was found guilty of murder in the first degree and sentenced to death by electrocution. 2 years later, however, McCollum was declared insane and spent many of the remainder of her years in Florida's state mental institution in Chattahoochee. These are the widely publicized facts of the story of Ruby McCollum. They are well documented in newspaper and magazine accounts of the murder and in a best-selling book published in 1956 by William Bradford Huey, Ruby McCollum, Woman in the Sewanee Jail. More than 50 years after Adams's murder, the story is still an immovable touchstone in Live Oak. The town remains much as it was in 1952. Elderly citizens who recall that hot August morning when McCollum killed one of Live Oak's most prominent and promising individuals are reluctant to discuss it. "Damn shame," most respond when questioned about the murder. "Ruby had no call to do what she done, but all that was a long time ago. Folks here have moved on." Such reticence is common, and considering the unwanted media spotlight trained on Live Oak immediately after Adams's murder and during McCollum's trial, perhaps it is to be expected. In 1952, outsiders were regarded with suspicion in Live Oak, and today they still are. To talk of Ruby McCollum is somehow vaguely impolite. The whole business was unseemly, and according to most people, the McCollum mess is best forgotten. It was an unpleasant event that resulted in unpleasant allegations, and in Live Oak, some things are best left unsaid. Because McCollum was allowed neither to fully tell her story in court nor to be interviewed during her long incarceration, exactly what happened in the days and hours prior to the murder will never be known. Notes and letters written by McCollum, however, allege years of mental and physical abuse she suffered at Adams's hand. For example, McCollum contends that on the day of the shooting, she was pregnant with Adams's child and had previously given birth to another child fathered by him. Yet if McCollum was never allowed to tell her story, ample evidence attests to the fact that she desperately wanted to tell it. "I am praying that you will come in to see me so that I can tell you the whole story," she wrote to Huey in 1954. At that time, powerful legal and cultural codes in Live Oak prevented anyone from breaking McCollum's silence and, more important, sullying the good name of Adams, a white man. Today, more than 50 years of silence in Live Oak have dictated a sanitized public version of why McCollum murdered Adams. That is, if one can even find members of the community willing to speak of the murder at all. Few will talk of McCollum, and if they do, it is to denounce her. Racial tensions in the early 1950s taught individuals in Live Oak hard lessons about what happens to folks, either black or white, who speak out of turn. McCollum tried to do it, and she was committed to a mental institution. Huey tried to do it, and he was jailed for contempt of court. Zora Neale Hurston, then a reporter for the Pittsburgh Courier, tried to do it, and she fled the community in fear for her life. The national media tried to do it, and citizens closed their ranks with the unanimous refrain, "No comment." Fear was the common denominator in all of these instances, dredging up ugly accusations in 1952 about a white man murdered by a black woman was not only futile, it was dangerous. This book examines the silencing of Ruby McCollum and the role of acts of silence in the preservation of a specific public memory in Live Oak and the South at large. By couching archival and other discursive formations in the context of this particular public memory, I aim to exemplify how dominant power and capital structures in the early 1950s South worked to protect Southern myths regarding race, class, and gender, and, more specifically, how these longtime myths contributed to the fate of one woman. As is evident in every turn of the McCollum case, these myths were infinitely more precious than dollars, and as such, they were protected and enforced at any price. They were the South's cultural capital, its raison d'être, and they were first and foremost defended by acts of silence. Frank interrogation into the silencing of Ruby McCollum is particularly important because acts of silence are not exclusive to her, the early 1950s, or the Southern United States. Cheryl Glenn, for example, writes in Unspoken, A Rhetoric of Silence, that current explorations into silence thus work to remind us of how much more we have to learn about women's and men's delivery of silence, especially when history, rhetoric, linguistics, politics, and culture offer us so many silent passages, some eventually, some never, spoken or heard. The case of Ruby McCollum is one such silent passage. Long buried as a painful chapter in the South's history, her trial and conviction are particularly compelling reminders of both the dynamics of acts of silence and the high cost of failing to recognize the rhetorical power inherent in them. Like speech, Glenn continues, the meaning of silence depends on a power differential that exists in every rhetorical situation. Who can speak? Who must remain silent? Who listens? And what those listeners can do? For me to somehow manage to forget Ruby McCollum, as so many others before me have done, or to ignore acts of silence that occurred during her trial and conviction would consequently mean a surrender of my hard-won agency, both as a woman and as a rhetorical scholar. Like it or not, convenient or not, the voice of Ruby McCollum resonates through my past, and this book is the result of my listening closely to acts of silence present in texts either written by or about her. Texts that previously have been either ignored or radically under-theorized. The silencing of Ruby McCollum, then, is much more than an isolated moment in the South's history, and to view it as such is to miss the scope of important work already begun by Glenn and others. This book is presented, then, both as a long-overdue historical analysis of the silencing of Ruby McCollum and as a modern-day cautionary tale regarding the often underestimated power of acts of silence, whenever and wherever they may occur. Cultural studies scholar Carrie Nelson calls for a return to rhetoric of a special historicized and politicized sort, rhetorical analysis that focuses on historically delineated struggles over meaning and form. Various sorts of texts and discourses would be studied in relation to one another within temporal frames, and it is precisely Nelson's relational approach to history, politics, and language that I adopt in this book. Specific documents written either by or about McCollum exemplify race, class, and gender constructions that in the 1950s South worked to perpetuate longtime Southern myths and preserve cultural capital. Taking into account both the meaning of these silences, their influence on McCollum, Live Oak, and the South, and their form, the manifestation of these silences by and in discursive formations, is my primary aim. Yet texts written about McCollum, whether newspaper articles, letters, or Huey's monograph, vary wildly in their representation of both her and the murder itself. And so it is often difficult to determine precisely where fact ends and fiction begins. J. Hillis Miller, however, reminds us that fiction presupposes that the world may not be ordered in itself or, at any rate, that the social and psychological function of fictions is what Speech Act theorists call performative. A story is a way of doing things with words. It makes something happen in the real world. By taking into account the created nature of texts generated by and about McCollum, I argue that acts of silence in the South have the dynamics of a linguistic speech act in three contexts: the town in which McCollum lived, her trial and imprisonment, and William Bradford Huey's 1956 text, Ruby McCollum, Woman in the Sewanee Jail, which describes both Adams's murder and Live Oak's reaction to it. John Searle writes that the task of a theory of performatives is to explain how the speaker can intend and the hearer can understand a second speech act from the making of the first speech act, the statement. Acts of silence in the South, then, function much like Searle's performatives. The second speech act inherent in them, the power of silence's statement in various discourse communities to filter that which is determined to be true from that which is determined to be false and consequently censured, is, I argue, the force from which silence derives both its power and its stealth. One way of conceptualizing this notion of silence as a performative speech act is through Kenneth Burke's theory of dramatism, a five-part organizational strategy that treats language and thought primarily as modes of action. Burke argues that the elements of his pentad function in relation to one another, the positioning of any term, therefore influences other terms relevant to the particular scene under discussion. In other words, as Burke writes, what is involved when we say what people are doing and why they are doing it? By identifying acts of silence as performative speech acts operating in specific contexts relating to McCollum, I aim to complicate Burke's question by asking, how do acts of silence as modes of action affect what people are doing and why they are doing it? Not even the most minor characters in the drama of Ruby McCollum are exempt from the ripple effect of silence. Patricia Yeager, for example, writes that in the South, political power not only penetrates local bodies, it seeps through people who seem inconsequential and suggests the public logic behind their disarray. An examination of local discourses informed by what happened in Live Oak on August 3, 1952, goes a long way toward answering the question of how acts of silence as modes of action function in texts informed by the case of Ruby McCollum. More important, however, these local silence-filled discourses can help us understand the public logic behind a much larger rhetorical politics of silence in the American South. If acts of silence in the McCollum case perform like a language, it is due in part to the fact that these silences are couched in rhetorical constructs that by their very nature are contingent and fluid. The catchphrases, like a language and like a text, Nelson cautions, need to be combined and historicized. An analysis of archival texts, both informing and informed by McCollum, then, is at once particularly necessary and difficult. For our perceptions to become known to us, Nelson writes, for us to be able to represent them to ourselves and others, they must be given linguistic form or its equivalent. At the very least, cultural studies can take such linguistic representations as cultural artifacts rather than as reflections of the real. In the case of McCollum, acts of silence manifest themselves in linguistic representations such as newspaper articles, letters, court documents, interviews, magazine articles, notes, and a monograph. But in spite of the diversity of these discursive formations, acts of silence evident in them are together indicative of cultural practices that, although in the case of Ruby McCollum are exemplified by specific acts of silence couched in specific historical texts, are not temporally exclusive to them. Consequently, this book aims to discuss texts surrounding the McCollum affair both as cultural artifacts within a specific historical framework and as linguistic acts that transcend time and contribute to a political, interested rhetoric of silence in the South and elsewhere. In a letter dated January 31, 1955, the editor of Live Oak's weekly newspaper condemned the galley proofs that Huey sent to him of Ruby McCollum. Throughout the book, I note a desire to belittle the country I love. Naturally, I resent this, and to see untrue facts used to do this, irksome. There is no fear here, as you picture. Rather, a calmness to be admired. It is well to remember that Live Oak and Suwanee County will endure when Bill Huey, the woman in the Suwanee jail, and every character there.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?